I'll turn on. That looks good. And just in case, we're turning on that. Okay. Today, the 24th of Adar, 5771, we're going to look at, we're going to go from 130 to 135, but a little bit out of order. So let's start with 130, to return property taken in robbery. So we looked before at the mitzvah that I don't remember the number of, but at the mitzvah that said we have to return a fifth, right? Add a fifth onto property that's stolen or into money that's stolen. So if somebody steals $100 or if somebody eats from something that's holy or set aside, so they have to return the $100 plus 20, really plus 25, right? Because we said that it's not just adding a fifth of the thing, but what you add on has to be a fifth of the entire amount. Pardon? Yeah?
Since I just now, have the book for the last couple weeks.
Yeah.
Are you going by Parsha, or are you just going straight through the book?
Straight through the book.
Okay.
Straight the book. So we're on page 83 in the second book. No, we're not really.
67. It would be 67.
That's
65.
Just the end
it
where
65.
I... Right, it's the end where I... Yeah, because I already went through there.
It's... we're on page 65. 127.
What's the 127?
That,
oh, the 127, the right, is adding on the 5th. Thank you.
I just remembered it.
127, right. So this is that you have to return property seized in robbery. And it's an interesting mitzvah. It's pretty long, so we're not going to go through all the details, but it is interesting. So let's say you steal something, right, and you have to return that thing. What happens if, as long as that thing is unchanged? Right, so now you're a cattle rustler. You stole some calves. Now they grew up, right, and so now they're cows. So they've changed. You can't return calves. You don't have calves. You have cows. So can you return them or not? Or do you have to return the monetary value of them?
I would say with cows, you probably return the cow, whereas it's not like you changed it into something different. It changed, but it just sort of, grew.
Right. So now let's say you stole a foal, grew into a horse, but you trained that horse and the horse's secretariat.
That's probably different.
Why did right?
you wait so long? Why did
well,
you wait so
but
long?
But you did. Now you're doing tshuva.
Yeah, there you go.
Read to the bottom of page 67.
Right? So, you actually do have to return the thing as long as it's not changed. If it changed like that, then you get the extra. So you could return secretariat to the owner, but the owner then has to give you the value of the difference between what he stole and what you made out of the thing. So you stole a foal. It was worth, $1,000. But now it's secretariat. It's worth $42 million. So as long as the owner has $41 million, whatever that is, minus that $42 million minus $1,000, so then you can return secretariat to the owner and he has to pay you the difference. Or
it's like that's a good incentive to steal.
Or you can give the $1,000. So you get to keep the difference in between, but you have to return the property, the value of the property. So then in that case, I'm not sure if it doesn't say in here if you have to return the fifth or not, if you're just returning the monetary value. But that's what it's talking about. Let's say so as long as it wasn't changed. So let's say you stole wool, but now you carded it, spun it, and made it into a sweater. It's no longer a pile of wool, and you can't make it back into a pile of wool. So you get to keep the sweater, but you have to return the value of what the pile of wool was worth. Let's say you stole boards and you made it into a doghouse. That, you can take the nails out, and it's a pile of usable boards again, right? So that you could return. So that's what it says, is you have to return the thing if you have the thing and it's unchanged. If it changed, you have to you have to give back the value. The one thing that's in here, in addition, the complicating factor, is did the owner maintain hope that it would be returned or not? So that plays in all these things. If it gained value while the owner was still retaining hope, let's say the lamb grew into a sheep, but really the owner was still hoping that the sheep rustler of the neighborhood would be caught and everybody would get their sheep back, and he's still hoping for that, then you get the value. The owner did not give up hope of his lamb turning into a sheep and the value of the sheep. He's still planning on thinking about it, right? So he's hoping to get it back. Let's say the sheep rustler has been working for years and nobody ever gets their stuff back. So pretty much the day he's rustled, right?
He's gone.
He's like, oh, now it's me. I'll never see those sheep again. But a month later, they catch him. So then I think he only has to return the value of what it was at the time that he gave up hope. So it's interesting that that plays in it. So the sub-theme is when you gave up hope for the item.
I thought if you gave up hope, you're not entitled to get it back at all.
Well, if they stole it from you, you are. It's different if you lose it.
Okay. Huh? That's the difference.
Because it does make a difference in lost items. Yeah, if you find a lost item and the person gave up hope.
So the thing is, never give up hope.
Well, so, but you do give up hope.
And that transfers to everything.
Right?
Well, it's confusing because in one place it says, okay, therefore, sages of blessed memory taught that if someone sees three bundles worth three perutot at the time of the robbery, and they became cheaper while with the robber until their price stood at two, then even if he returned two, he is duty bound to return the third.
This right. Well, that's because
value.
Of the value.
Has to do with value.
Right.
That has not to do with value. Hope or not.
Right.
Hope.
Right.
Right. And then
because that's a third. It's a third sub concept there. The third sub concept is that if it's something that's worth less than a pruta, which is about a penny, then you still stole. But we count on the generosity of the Jewish people to not desire it back, that they'll let go of it.
Because it was so valueless.
So, for instance, you used somebody's pen without permission. You stole that amount of ink. But it's definitely worth less than a pruta. So even though you shouldn't have done it, and you need to apologize and make amends, but you don't have to figure out how to scrape the ink back off or... Right, and return it, or give less than a pruta back. You know, you don't have to return that amount of money, because how much was it? It was like, you know, it's not a penny's worth of ink.
Are you held accountable for it?
Well, so you still stole. Yeah.
So you still have to.
You still have to do tshuva.
Ink.
Yes. We're strict on stealing. So we're very careful with that stuff. So that's why if you have a guest, you want to tell a guest, you know, you can use... whatever you want to tell them, they can use anything in the house or anything that, you know, normally a person would borrow or use, you know, pens, paper, whatever, you know, aspirin, or tell them what they can't use. You know, please ask before you take anything because, you know, I'm that type of a person and I'm careful about it. But if you don't, like there are certain things that we take for granted in today's society, like using people's paper and pens, which is not... actually okay Jewishly. So as a hostess...
Well, it was probably at a time when
you should
paper
say.
And pens had a much greater
right.
value, not only in general, but also to an yeah. individual.
Yeah.
I once tried to return a pen to somebody. They didn't want it back.
Right.
It has such little value.
Right, right.
But you go to Cuba and people were yeah. lining up...
We were in a hotel and I needed a pen and I went to four people like at the check-in desk and this and that and the other in the whole lobby there was one pen.
Wow.
One pen.
And we would stop the bus and people would ask us, do
you have pens? Wow, right. So
this is 3 years ago.
We don't understand that because
right.
We buy them by the dozen
yeah, right. yeah,
or
exactly.
by the six dozen in Costco.
Exactly.
Right? They're sent in the mail.
And then they're just annoying all over the house. What do you do with all those pens? You know, it's like...
But when you need one, you can't find one.
Of course. That's for sure true. That's why I just said I'm going to keep a pin next to the phone so I can just prick my finger and write in blood. I can never find a pen when I need it. But nobody will take the pin.
That's cute. So you're saying when you have a guest, you should tell them?
What they can use.
Whatever. Well, they're going to use your toilet paper, and they're going to use...
Clean. Right, right.
But so what about the customer?
That's customer. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Please feel free to use what you need in my house. Make yourself at home. Now, that way they don't have to ask, like, let's say
okay
toothpaste.
Right.
Well, they're not going to ask, but you're putting a stumble. That way you're
right. You're removing a stumble. Because let's say toothpaste. That's not necessarily. For sure, toilet paper and tissues in the bathroom, you expect everybody to take. But you're not sure. Like, but you would say, it's fine. You could use my toothpaste. But really, you should ask. If you're in somebody else's house and you didn't bring toothpaste, but you have your toothbrush and you want to brush it, you should say, do you mind if I take some toothpaste?
Yeah, but if the toothpaste is in the bathroom, then...
Well, you still should ask.
But if it's in the cabinet...
You still should ask. So that's what I'm saying. That's
it's
a tiny amount.
Probably.
But Jewishly, we are careful with that tiny amount. We Jews are careful with other people's property. So we don't take something like that. That's the Jewish thing. Don't take something like that without knowing that it's okay.
Right. So, unless you leave it in the bathroom and say there's toothpaste there if you need it. And whatever.
Right. So that's what you say when you have a guest. You say, please feel free to use anything that's in the bathroom. Right? That way they can use the shampoo and the cream rinse and the toothpaste. And, you know,
you
if they need something more private, they could
right.
look in a drawer and look for something more private. Like if they need, like, I don't know, monthly products or things like you know, they could look for it. You don't have to say, please feel free to take.
Don't say.
You know? Not on tapes.
Not on tapes.
I see.
So whatever, I'm just saying, like, that sometimes you could, like, you know, just tell people they're free to, and then that way you would also be careful not to keep your private prescriptions in that bathroom.
Yeah, right.
Right.
That's right.
But then you can say, please feel free to use anything you find in the bathroom. That gives them permission to use whatever they might need and look for something they might need if they don't have it. And they don't have to ask you an embarrassing question then later. Mm-hmm. So, right. So, okay, so that's returning property taken in a robbery. I just wanted to point out this last thing that it says. It applies in every place and every time for both man and woman. If someone violates it, committing robbery and not returning what he has taken, he thus disobeys a positive precept apart from the prohibition which he violates during the robbery. So you're not supposed to rob and you're supposed to return. So if you robbed, that's one prohibition. But if you didn't return what you took, that's a separate one. And here's a sentence that says, and woe to him.
Where are you?
On the bottom of 71, turning to 73. Woe to him who has it in his power to straighten out what is crooked, and he does not set it aright before his death.
Ooh.
So it's something for everybody to think about. What might you... Is there a book you borrowed that you never returned? Is there? These are things we need to...
I have a green book.
Right. So we actually have to kind of work on that if we can.
Every minute you're at work, that you're not working...
Right. So that's something actually to talk to an employer about. And that actually is something very serious today with the internet.
Oh my gosh.
How much forwarding of emails and stuff. And so that is stealing from an employer.
So if the employers would have to say, you're allowed to chit-chat on my time.
Yes.
Probably. Most employers would not say that.
Right.
But if they do, then it's okay.
Then it's okay. But if they don't, then you can't.
Do they have to explicitly state it to their employees?
Yes. They do.
Not just have the attitude, it's okay.
No, you would have to know that they clearly have that. They've expressed it somewhat. Yes. No, you need to know. Otherwise, at work, you need to make sure that it's only during your breaks. You have, you know, a break in the morning, a break in the afternoon, a lunch break. That's when you look at your personal emails. That's when you check your eBay auction. That's when you make a personal phone call, and you don't during the rest of the time. And if you do, let's say the doctor calls you with your test results, right? Mm-hmm. That's before your break, right? So you just pay attention, 10 minutes.
Right. Take it off your time.
Yeah.
Work 10 minutes later.
Work 10 minutes more. That's right.
Lori Palatnik's brother did shiputzim, which is repairs in our apartment in Jerusalem, and he had a cell phone, and I said, you know, Randy, please answer your cell phone. He said, I don't do that. It's stealing time from you. You're my employer.
Right. So then if you say that,
blown away.
then you have given him permission.
But he still said, I won't do
it. Right. So, but you're allowed to grant that permission. You're allowed to say, while you're working for me, I allow you to answer your cell phone. I'd rather you not chat forever, but it's okay if you take a call. It's fine. Take a short call. That's fine.
Right.
Yeah, that's fine with me. So you could say that, but he's right. If he's on your time without that permission, he would not be permitted to answer. Right, so let it go to voicemail and he'll answer it later on his time. Yeah, it's tricky.
We got a lot of Jewish people in our office.
So in your office, then you have to make an office policy about it.
Not me, the bosses.
Mm-hmm. The bosses.
It'd be hard to get them to do that.
Since they're contributing to the...
No, because they feel like, you know, it's just hard to tell people.
It is.
It's hard to say to somebody.
Don't check your email.
You're welcome to chit chat whenever you want because there's a lot of it that goes on.
Well, so then they might want to say, please chit chat during break times.
I don't think it's that
hard. It's very hard. People waste a ton of time.
Yeah.
The internet and all those jokey emails and stuff that go around. Water cooler is one thing, and that's a little more limited, and people, like, see you standing at the water cooler.
You could be checking your thing.
You could be checking your stuff, and nobody sees it, and you can spend a lot of time and not even realize
totally.
It. People spend hours a day.
Yeah.
When I hear all of these people doing Facebook, it's like, when do they have time?
Oh, they have time at work.
That's right.
I know. Donnie just bought something on eBay yesterday, and he said, I can't believe I got $30 worth of silver for $7.02. He said, it's probably because nobody's at work checking their eBay accounts, because it's a day off. I said, what?
Wow.
He said, yeah, that's when the eBay auctions are really active, is when people are at work.
Are you kidding?
Wow. And he knows this because he's doing it at school.
He does. Yeah, he does it still sometimes. But yeah, yeah, he does know. No, he knows enough about that stuff. Right. Okay. Now we're up to 131. The precept of lifting off the ash from the altar. So back to Beit HaMikdash ideas. So this is an interesting concept. It is a sacred task to clean up the altar, both because you're preparing it, you're doing temple activity, but also because you're making it so that the fire will burn more brightly. So the Kohen does this. He has a specific garment for this, which is different than the garments he wears for other holy tasks, for offerings and things like that. There's a specific garment worn for removing the ashes, and it's a whole ceremony. It's interesting that it says here in the second paragraph, by way of analogy, that it's not fitting to wear those garments with the other garments that he wears to serve, because in the clothing in which he has cooked a pot of food for his master, one should not pour a cup of wine for his master. Mm-hmm. So while they are sacred garments, they're cleanup clothes. It's your kitchen clothes, not your serving clothes. You know, there's different clothes that you wear for, you know, when you're cooking and when you're serving. So also here.
While we're on the subject,
yes.
It seems like when they're wearing their beautiful, ornate uniforms mm-hmm. or clothing, garments, they're sprinkling blood on themselves. Are they only good for one use, or do they wash them? Or
I'm sure they wash them,
because
but different people do different activities, so
maybe they wore an apron.
It seemed like the activities they're engaged in while they're wearing these
kind of bloody and yucky, right?
Yeah. Would not preserve them for very long.
They have OxyClean.
Yeah, I think they did have OxyClean. I mean, they certainly had a system of water that washed through the Beit HaMikdash that kept it clean. And in the first temple time, they had 10 open miracles, and one of them was that it never smelled bad, and there was never a fly.
Which is pretty miraculous.
Pretty miraculous, right. With all that blood and guts and meat and stuff, there was never a fly in the first temple. Second temple didn't have those miracles, but the first one did. So I wonder if there was a miracle. I mean, it's not listed in Pirkei Avot in the list of the 10, but it would make sense that there might be some kind of a miracle with stain resistance and those types of clothes. Who knows?
It's like the clothes in the desert never got dirty and never got
That's
worn.
Right. They never wore out and they never got dirty. Right.
True.
So maybe there was something like that. So it just talks about when was the ash lifted off? Every day when the dawn came up on the festivals, from the middle third of the night, on the Day of Atonement, from midnight. How is it lifted off? The one who won, because they won in a lottery, the privilege to do this, and it fell on his lot to remove it, would undergo ritual immersion in the mikvah, put on the clothing for the removal, and sanctify his hands and feet by rinsing them. And his brother Kohanim would tell him, so this is part of the whole procedure. There's a mikvah, there's a rinsing, there's
thing.
An outfit, there's
a
procedure. Yeah.
And then, on holidays
and then a whole statement from the brother Kohanim, beware lest you touch a holy object until you sanctify your hands and feet. So I guess in between the mikvah and the changing and before the washing, he shouldn't touch anything that he was not ready to touch. After that, he'd take the censer, which is made out of silver, and there's a special way of doing the whole thing. So it's interesting to think of. So there is ceremony, clearly. But just to remember that the ceremony, it is about doing something physical to affect a spiritual result. That's the whole pattern that we see here in mitzvot. A mitzvah is something that's physical that achieves a spiritual end. So there's a whole way to do it. But also it's important to look from here and see the importance of preparation. The importance of engaging in that which makes other things possible as a holy task. And look at how much ceremony is in this, just the removing of the ash so that it works. It could not be a mitzvah at all, you know, but God made it into a mitzvah so that by doing this physical thing, which is really just sweeping out the coals, you know, sweeping out the ash, that's actually a holy thing to do. And I think we could bring that into our lives as we think about taking out the compost or the garbage or sweeping the floor so that, or particularly making the floor safe after a spill, you know, cleaning up the glass or making sure that it's not slippery or something like that, that may seem just like, of course, you're just doing what's necessary to make life work, but it's actually a holy task.
You elevate it by thinking about what you're doing.
Right, that it can be a holy task.
Can make the mundane holy.
Right. Right.
So jump.
Right. So that's what we're doing. Right.
It's all in details.
It is. Right. Okay. Let's see. Now we're going to skip to 134 and 35, and then we'll go back. Okay. So 134 is the precept of eating the remainders of meal offerings. So when a mincha offering is brought, the Kohanim are commanded to eat the remnants of the meal offering. So they take off a little bit that's burned on the altar, and they're supposed to eat the rest. And they're not supposed to give that to somebody else to do. They're supposed to do it. So basically, this is back in the... That's why I just stuck these in the middle, because I wanted to have less conversation about these and more about the next two. But these two are really just about how to procedurally take care of the meal offerings. So a little bit gets offered, the rest gets eaten by the Kohanim. That's mitzvah 134 and 135.
What if you have like 500 people that come to make a mincha offering that day?
I think there's a lot of kohanim.
Okay.
One bite.
Well, it says all the rest.
Right. No, you have to eat all the
rest. All the
rest.
You have to eat the whole thing.
I don't know enough to know.
All of it, or they spread it out?
No, you can spread it out among all the kohanim. But, and I don't know enough to tell you, could there be 500 in a day? Excuse me, I don't know. Would that ever happen? Was it 10 in a day? I don't know what the rhythm of offering was. But I do know that there's plenty of kohanim, actually.
Not all the kohanim came to the temple every day.
No, they didn't. They didn't.
What, they had an assignment?
Yeah. Yeah, they did. They had a rotation.
They had a rotation.
Mm-hmm. Maybe they were on call.
I wonder if there were some who were on call, but they did have rotations. I mean, the whole thing was worked out. Had they had rotations and additional people for holidays, even more, I'm sure, for Pesach, when everybody comes with Ole HaRegel. Mm-hmm. Sukkot also, you need a bunch of kohanim. There's all kinds of offerings brought by the different nations. So they definitely had a system by which the kohanim were brought up in different chunks. They were chunked out and brought in different groups. And then the groups were divided into watches, so that they worked different watches around the clock, so that and they all had different tasks. So, and they had a place to sleep in the Beit HaMikdash. It was a whole big system. It was a big deal. I just read a book by my friend Katriel Sugarman, who writes about the Third Temple and what it will be like. But he writes about it today. Like, it's here now with the current technology. Yeah, it is actually interesting. So he talks about, you know, the temple website and, you know, how you go into to get the information to where the Tahara stations are, you know, and you're, the procedures internet. For Tahara, on the internet, the
on
procedures
Google.
For Tahara. So that you,
that,
right,
yeah.
So you can Google, like, what's the closest Tahara station to you and the pitfalls to avoid on the way from your mikvah point until the mikdash. Like, how will you know what tummy things not to touch? You know, you could use a GPS for that. Right? And it also talks about the Mikdash Institute, where people come to learn, you know, all these things, and the non-Jews who come to learn, because it's, you know, it's no more conversions at this point, but non-Jews want to learn Torah, and the Torah of the non-Jews. So as I'm reading it, I'm thinking, I want to teach there. I better learn what I have to learn so I could teach in that Mikdash Institute. You know, like,
you better start a plan.
Yeah.
It's coming soon.
Yeah. It sounded really exciting to teach in the Mikdash Institute. They have all their own airport, Mikdash Airport, Mikdash trains, and the whole system for bringing in the animals for the Korbanot. And like, it was just interesting to think about what it was like and the media and the... And the broadcast
media
station.
Center. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Got to have a media center to broadcast who brought what.
Mm-hmm. You know,
so
what it would be like.
Animal sacrifices.
In this version, yes.
We don't really know.
We're waiting, yeah. It's a machloket.
There is a sentence here that's interesting.
Yes.
As for a female kohen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's female kohenim.
And they can actually do the rituals.
Well,
It doesn't say that.
Well, a handful they can is eat. Taken from her mincha, and the remainder is
what,
eaten.
Page
83?
Yes. 83,
yeah. Right,
well, so it
just female kohanim.
Right, so they don't. So female kohanim, it's a status, and that status doesn't. A female kohen doesn't work in the Beit HaMikdash, and she doesn't really. As far as I understand, she also doesn't even have the status, let's say, of teacher, which male kohanim have. But she does have status, blood status of being a kohen, so she can eat the holy foods that only kohanim can eat.
And she can't do the rituals that make them holy.
Correct, right.
Would be an unmarried daughter of a kohen. Would it also be the wife kohen?
Yes, so an Asha kohen can, the unmarried daughter can, the married daughter can when she goes home. So if she goes, you know, to mom and dad for the Seder,
she's
allowed
to
eat. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She's allowed to eat the holy food. So let's say they have a fruit salad from the sanctified fruit. She could have it, but her husband can't. So I would imagine they'd get special foods for him too, but as nice in-law parents, but she could have it. Or let's say she visits with her kids and she's going to visit her parents. So then she could eat it. I don't think her kids can eat it though. But she can have it.
Unless she was married to a Kohen.
Unless she's married to a Kohen, in which case the whole family is Kohenim. She's an Isha Kohen too. So then they can all have it. But that's similar to Pesach today. Depending on the family, ask your Rav. I don't want to be paskening here. But there are married women who, with halachic consent, when they go to their parents' house, can eat foods that their husband doesn't eat on Pesach.
You're saying...
So let's say somebody marries a man who doesn't eat gebrachts, but she goes home for Pesach, she could eat gebrachts. Let's say a Sephardic woman marries an Ashkenazi man. When she goes home to her parents, she can eat rice. Yeah, right, or whatever, kidney out, right.
Right.
Right, so that seems to apply
now
circumstance.
Does she eat kidney out at her home?
No.
No, not at her home, but at her parents'.
No, but she's married to a Sephardi,
a Sephardi woman who came from a house that eats kidney out. Marries the Ashkenazi man who does not eat kidney oats.
That I understand. What about the other way around? Ashkenazi woman marries a Sephardi.
Right, then she's Sephardic. She can eat kidney oats.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You take on. So there's nothing that the Ashkenazim don't eat something that Sephardim.
Right.
Ashkenazim.
Don't hold by Sephardim.
No. So the Sephardim, let's see, how can I say it? There's not a stringency that the Ashkenazim don't have that the Sephardim do have. I don't think that would work in the reverse necessarily. Maybe, let's say an Ashkenazi woman marries a Sephardi man and he only eats the chalak Beit Yosef. He only eats Beit Yosef Shechita. The top Shechita on the planet that's completely smooth. It's not like regular glatt. There is nothing at all whatsoever. Right? It's a very stringent level. And if he's careful in that, then that's the way their home is. But she goes back to her parents, and her parents eat only regular glatt. She may be permitted to eat only regular glatt rather than the Beit Yosef, which is what she would eat at home. Anyway, so...
If a woman keeps 6 hours between milk and meat, and marries a man that only keeps three, let's say.
You get to keep three. That woman gets to keep three. Do you have to? Well, you'd want to.
Really? You don't want to be fleshed for 2 years.
Right. Right. Many people, if they could, would wait into the first. But pardon?
It's a 5 1/4, as I understand.
Some people do 5 1/4. That's into the sixth. And some people do a whole six, a solid six. If you do three, it has to be a solid three. You can't, it can't be 2 hours and 59 minutes. It has to be three. Solid. Same with one. Solid. This community is Balei Tshuva. Balei Tshuvas often go by their rabbi. This rabbi in this community is of German extraction, so he waits 3 hours. So the Aish community, in general, is a 3-hour community.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even know.
Yeah. So,
How about the Zera Abraham community?
The Zera Abraham community is a 6-hour community in general. And it's interesting
because
the Zera Abraham community. So I have been, it's interesting, I mean, I had a Baal Tshuva rabbi told me condescendingly, I wait three, that real Yerei Shemayim wait six. I was like,
that's
really?
How I feel.
Good to know. I guess I'm not a real Yerei Shemayim. I don't know. I weigh three. But I feel like I'm a real Yerei Shemayim. And I'm basing it on shilas that I've asked. It's not like I just picked, which some people can just pick. But
throw a dart.
I definitely asked. So I weigh three. But it was interesting that this... there is the reason why I'm bringing it out is we do not have to fall prey to judging how righteous we are or others are by how many hours we wait.
Right.
That is not something that we need to engage in.
What's the purpose of waiting six instead of three?
There is a genuine halachic... One and six are the halachic
Three is in the
They're based on halacha.
That's pretty far apart, 1 and 6.
1 and 6 are the two halacha
shitas. But nobody
shitas.
Does one.
Really?
Yes, yes, yes. The Dutch Jews do one. Dutch. It's a Dutch tradition only. So my husband said, don't you know our name is actually Vanderbulo?
Vanderbulo.
No, it's actually not.
Sounds good to me.
Right. So he tried.
How did the Dutch end up with 1 hour?
That's a halachic shita. Yes, 1 and 6 are based thoroughly, solidly in halacha. 3 seems not to be. However, it is a very strong minhag, and it is the minhag of the German Jews. So all Jews of German extraction, all the Yekis, keep 3, and that's you can rely on that. Baal tshuvas, especially those who like to be stringent, want to go with a stringent 6, which can cause a lot of problems, especially if it's in a marriage, if it's mixed, you know, with what, who keeps what and where, and so then you're worried about, you know, lunch and how far away is lunch from dinner and all, constantly thinking about it. So so that's something for a Baal Tshuva to contend with. The other, in addition to maybe just wanting to be stringent, the other reason a Baal Tshuva would choose 6 is if they do their own research and find that in their family, they're relatively recently, couple of generations, and they ask a shayla about it, that was their family minhag, and so they choose their family's minhag. But you don't just choose one. If you're choosing a minhag package,
you have to choose all of them.
You're supposed to choose a minhag package. Now, Baal Tshuvas, again, often do pick one of these and one of these and one of these and make their own, you know, kind of mishmash. It's not a real package. But you're supposed to pick a rav and go by that rav. So
find a 3-hour rav.
Which is not hard to do in this community because the leader of this community is a 3-hour guy. Right, I'm saying. But, you know, Rabbi Meir is the rabbi of age. He's not even a junior rabbi. He's not even an associate rabbi. He's the guy. And he's a 3-hour guy. So everybody gets to pick. That's the way it is. But you should pick with halachic guidance. That's the concept of a selach harav. So you don't just make these decisions in a vacuum. You do speak to somebody. Particularly when it's causing any kind of friction at home. It's important to ask. Okay, that being said, let's...
So you can't go back and forth on your... Well, no, because...
Which back and forth?
I don't know. Because I think I've heard that, you know, for Passover, that okay, so you don't eat rice, but then you're... So, oh, we're going to do Sephardic Seder or something like that, and so then they might serve Sephardic foods at the Seder because...
Right, so those people who are careful in the halacha would not use the occasion of the Seder to explore different foods that would be out of their own tradition, halachically. Doesn't mean you can't try to find Sephardic spices. If you can find quinoa, is not kidney oat. You can eat that on Pesach.
Right. Well, you know that.
But... let's say you find cumin, that's kosher la Pesach, right? So some people don't eat that seed, but it seems that we do eat that seed. Many do, Ashkenazim do, but it's a Sephardic flavor. So you might make Sephardic flavored chicken, you know, but it doesn't mean that, yeah, you can make Sephardic haroset. That's dried.
We always have
so
that.
It's not necessarily
yeah, we do
just tradition,
we always
it's
have
halacha.
That.
Halacha
it's halacha, yeah.
Which type of... either Ashkenazic or Sephardic that you follow.
Oh, if you're Ashkenazic or Sephardic is from family heritage.
You don't get to
if
choose.
You convert, you get to choose. But then it goes by the male of the relationship. If you're married, it goes by the male. So the male...
but that's more tradition than halacha.
No, that's halacha. Because the question is, which set of traditions and halachas do you follow?
How do they come up with 2 sets of halachas?
Now, that's an excellent question. It's related to history, and I'd be happy to answer that at a different time because I do want to get to these 2 things. But it's a fascinating answer, how they came up with it. They did. Should I answer any of that now?
All derived from the 1 oral Torah?
Yes, it is.
Different interpretations, obviously.
Not always. The oral Torah unfolds based on circumstance also. So... for instance, kidney oat. Why don't we eat kidney oat? That's because, and that's why don't Ashkenazim eat kidney oat? Because Ashkenazim were from Europe, where they ground lots of things into grain, where they didn't have much food altogether. Cold lands, right? Thinking about Ashkenazim and Sephardim divided, not as European and Oriental. I couldn't figure out why they said Oriental. Think about them as from Christian lands, from Muslim lands, right? And now you can think a different way, from cold places, from sunny, delightful places. It's a big difference. But the Ashkenazim all come from cold, miserable places where the Christians were mean to them all the time. They had a rough life from the get-go. Whereas the Jews from the Sephardic Jews had a much easier time. The Muslims were not always nice, but not as bad as the Christians. Mm-hmm. The Christians were horrible to the Jews all the time. And there were definitely times where it worked out much better for the Jews under Muslim rule. And they were from sunny, lovely places where people are more relaxed and more friendly altogether.
Happier.
And the Torah developed differently in those places. So going to a place where there was not very much food and where they ground everything into flour to make anything edible, so then you have to worry, is that wheat flour? Is it rice flour? Is it bean flour? So we don't eat kidney oat because we're careful about flours. Of course, you could tell the difference between bean and wheat as a piece. Mm-hmm. But once it's ground or mixed, it's really hard to tell the difference. So the Ashkenazim adopted that stringency, whereas in the Sephardic lands, there's plenty of food. You know, all kinds of yummy things because it was lovely, warm, abundant territories where the Sephardim lived. So they didn't have to take on that stringency at all.
They could tell the difference. They didn't.
And they could tell the difference. They weren't grinding everything into flours just to live, where the Ashkenazim were, just to live. Right? So it was different there. So that's one big piece. Another piece, so that's kidney oat. Let's just say Beit Yosef, the Sephardic standard for glot, which is, glot means smooth, so nothing in the lungs. So any little spot that might show that the animal had a disease from which it would die within a year would render it not kosher. So now the question is, when you find a spot, does that mean it was sick or not sick? So you have to figure it out, right? So people who are super stringent wanted, I don't even want something somebody figured out. I want no need to figure out meat. You know, I want glot. However, the Ashkenazim really had problems getting super glot. So their definition of glot is mostly smooth. Less questionable marks, but not none. But the Sephardim standard is none at all whatsoever. How is that possible? So the Sephardim worked with the Muslims, which needed halal shechita. So the Jews in the Sephardic lands, the Jews killed all the animals. Whatever wasn't perfect went to the Muslims, who needed ritually slaughtered animals. Whatever they didn't like, the Christians of those places took the bottom. Right, so the Jews paid $1.10 per pound, the Muslims paid $1 per pound, and the Christians paid 90 cents per pound. But that's how it worked. Mm. So there was this tiny premium for the Jews. Whereas in the Ashkenazic lands, where the Christians hated the Jews and they were totally separate, so the Jews pooled their money, bought the animal, killed the animal. If the animal wasn't kosher, the Christians knew. So they'd pay 30 cents on the dollar, 20 cents on the dollar for that meat, which they knew the Jews couldn't use. So the Jews had to do every which way to figure out how could you make this kosher? The loss is so great. So they learned. So it's not a different. So the halacha
develops,
right? So
rabbinic.
Yes. Decisions. Yes. 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 So, and then I would imagine that the 1 and 6 hours both developed differently, but I'm not sure, based on understandings of digestion. You know, so based on understandings, and we didn't have good understandings. My partner in Torah is a doctor and very smart, Harvard educated. She was just telling me how she was reading in French the other night about the Antarctic, which she just went to, and she recognized from their descriptions some of the different places that she went and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, she's that type, right? And she has also a master's in philosophy of science. So I asked her, how was it that medieval doctors were so ignorant? How? Like, they were so clueless. Didn't they cut a body open ever? No. Not at all. She said that
was
it. Not at all. In the Christian lands, not at all. The church completely repressed information. I said, what about the Muslim lands? Like, wasn't there somebody who cut open a body? No. She said no. That the Muslims also and the Jews were very respectful of dead bodies. They're just, you wouldn't cut into one just to explore it. Just not part of what was done. So it wasn't until the Enlightenment that they were actually able to map out the body and
the
systems.
And even then, when you read about it, there's a whole period of time when it was all done in secret and,
all kinds of grave robbers.
Oh, yeah. And all that early.
Right. But that's what I was wondering. Did nobody rob a grave in 1,000 And really, you had to wait until the 1670s?
If they did, they didn't tell anybody about it. If they did,
well,
they didn't
Well, we know when they robbed the graves, because they took the stuff.
They took the stuff, but not the bodies.
Right.
I'm saying, but did nobody, like, you know, cut open a homeless indigent person?
I'm sure that it was done.
Well,
they just didn't
like
tell
Egyptian
anybody.
Egyptian times, they opened up.
Yeah,
the body
that's what I'm wondering. Like, what? Where was
what
the loss?
What between?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's what when I went to Egypt and I saw what the Egyptians had built and where they were in 1983 when I was there.
Right.
It's like,
how did this happen?
Build the pyramids, which we cannot do today with our computers?
Right.
And then you end up with people living in cemeteries.
Right. How does that work? It's a good question. Meanwhile, we have a few more minutes, and let's look at these two here. The precept of kindling the fire on the altar and not to put out any fire on the altar. So I want to look at these both physically and allegorically as well. So the precept on page 75, Mitzvah 132, the precept of kindling the fire on the altar, that there must be a fire that's burned all day long. You have to keep a fire going, a ner tamid, right? It has to be there. It has to be always a fire on the altar. So you, the Kohanim, are required to constantly be bringing wood and just keep a fire going all the time. This is actually a pretty long mitzvah here, if you look at it.
It is.
And so it talks about bringing it and it being all the time. But what's interesting about it is that we know that the way the karbanot are burned is from a heavenly fire, not from an earthly fire. A fire descends from heaven to burn the korban. So what's with the earthly fire? So in this mitzvah, it talks about the fact that Hashem really prefers to do miracles in natural-looking ways. And so we should bring an earthly fire. It should not be obvious that the fire comes from above. You know, people should be able to think that the fire comes from below. So that's number one. It's just that, so that's what he talks about here. Let's see. On page 77, regarding the root purpose of this precept, let me begin with a preface. It is a matter well known to us and to every man of wisdom that when God does major miracles for human beings in his great goodness, he always works them in a hidden way, and the matters seem the natural order. For even about the miracle of the division of the Red Sea, which was a renowned miracle, it is written, the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all the night and made the sea dry land and the waters were divided. Those with intelligence will understand that this matter of hiddenness is on account of the exalted state of the Lord and the lowly state of the recipient. So it's interesting that he wants to do it in a way that makes us feel like that's normal, just out of the normal.
Well, it's like a test for us.
Well, so it allows us to maintain free will. You know, if it can look normal. And it, look at us today. I mean, we're busy chatting on cell phones to people on different continents. Even the truth is, chatting on a cell phone to somebody next door, it's just as big a miracle. I mean, you're talking on a tiny little thing. Yeah, flying an airplane. You get
still
into this.
Gets me every time.
I know. You go up in the air, and it's like,
I fly.
It is. It's amazing.
In Denver, it's amazing.
It is. So all these miracles that we just totally take for granted because we have our little explanations for how they work, you know. Mm-hmm. Even the miracle of life, you know, so we all know, you know, one cell meets another cell, they get together and then they divide, and pretty soon you have a whole human being.
And all the parts specialize into the parts that you
it's
need.
It's amazing.
It is amazing.
It's a total miracle. But because we're used to it, so it's very easy for us to say, oh, yeah, well, whatever, that's the way bodies work. You know, it's all science. You know, it's not miracles at all. So Hashem prefers to operate in that way so that you can be in choice if you'd like to see miracles all around you, if you just like to see scientific facts all around you. That's up to you. You get to pick. But so that's part of lighting this fire. more than that, though, he points out another thing that's interesting here. So the fourth paragraph on page 77, it remains necessary for us to convey what the significance of the religious duty was to kindle fire on the altar apart from the fire needed there for the offerings. We would say, by way of the plain meaning, that in substance it is akin to what we wrote about the precept of the showbread, that man is blessed according to his activities in which he engages for the goodwill of his Creator. By this approach, this is an interesting concept here, we say that blessing would be manifest in all ordinary bread on account of our occupation with the mitzvah, the sacred bread. As you might say by way of analogy, the blessing spreads through its kind. So that's an interesting thing to think about, that when we sanctify one thing, other things in our life become sanctified. So right?
This is spiritual reality.
Yeah, right. So that's what he's saying here. But it's interesting to think about. So similarly, the occupation with the religious duty of fire every day was that man should be blessed in regard to the aspect of fire in him. So now, thinking about medieval understandings of bodies, so we understand that he understands that there are basic humors within a body, one of which is fire. So if, and we do have a concept of fire in us, whatever that means, so he's thinking more medievally, but we should be thinking allegorically as well in order to understand this. So he says by dealing with fire in a sanctified way, we sanctify the fire that's within us. And he gives a source, also he gives an explanation, which is interesting. Now, what is this fire? It is the force of nature in man. For out of the four elements in man, this force is fire. And it is the chief one of the four, since with it man is strengthened and can move and function. Therefore, blessing is most needed in it. The aim of a blessing is wholeness, something that has nothing missing and nothing superfluous. So the element of fire in man is in need of this blessing, that there should be in man the amount of it that he needs, not less, for his strength will be weakened, and not more, for then he will be burnt by it, in the way of people who die from an increase of fire in them beyond the norm, which is fever. The sons of Aaron added fire without being commanded. Hence, fire was added within them, and they were burnt. For according to a person's activity will his punishment come, or the blessing of the Lord will rest upon him. So I think that's interesting, too.
Moderation.
Right? Well, the moderation concept, for sure. But also the fact that what we engage in creates a spiritual reaction. So in what we do something physically, and it creates a spiritual reaction that manifests physically. So so I just thought that was an interesting thought there in that. In that one. So the second half of the verse that says to have that fire burning, and I put it in English here because it could be sort of a meditative sentence for people who like to say sentences over as a form of meditation. Eish tamid tokad al hamizbeach lo techbe. So I remember once Rabbi Abitan of blessed memory in Long Beach explained this verse about how there has to be an eternal fire and it shouldn't go out. And he explained it in terms of faith and trust, that we have to constantly work on maintaining the fire that's within us and not let it go out, both things. So constantly give fuel to the fire of our faith and trust in relationship with God, that it should be an eternal fire burning all the time, and protect ourselves from letting it go out. Two different things. So feed the fire and protect it from being extinguished. So one could think that in repeating this verse, that is a way of Jewish meditation, is to repeat verses.
Can you translate that? Fire,
Eish tamid, an eternal fire. So it's fire shall be kept burning on the altar continuously. It shall not go out. So it's interesting the way it says, Eish tamid tokad. Tokad is passive, shall be kept burning. I'm not even sure of the root of tokad, but the vav there makes it passive. And that's why the translation in English over here, fire shall be kept burning on the altar continuously. It shall not go out. So it's not just necessarily your obligation personally, even with your faith. I think you could think about it. It's not just up to you. It's a communal effort. It shall be kept burning. So we're actually responsible for other people too. If you think about a communal, what is an altar? Actually, it's the place where we bring a korban. It's the place where we become closer to God. So if we think about that communal fire that's burnt in the temple, but the communal fire that's within us all now, it's all of our responsibility to add to that and to protect it from being extinguished. So I think it's something to think about in our conversations with others. sometimes we find out things that could be faith-challenging for us. When somebody behaves dishonestly, or when you find schmutz in something that you didn't expect to find it in, you know, some person or some leader or some. So we don't always have to share that information, you know, because even if it's true and even if the papers discussed it, and if you need to discuss it for your own self, you're allowed to discuss it privately with somebody. But we want to consider the fact that we shouldn't let the fire go out in other people, you know, and just to be careful of that type of information. So that's this, right, this second mitzvah that I think is just Where did I want to bring something in here? Because I did flag it. Among the laws of this precept, for the second one, to not put out the fire on the altar, is what the sages of blessed memory said, that even if someone took the fire off the altar and then put it out, he is given whiplashes. So if it's the altar fire. But as for the fire of the censer for burning the incense, or the fire for lighting the menorah, that's already a separate fire, and if that goes out, that's okay. But the fire of the communal altar itself has to be protected.
And you're not allowed to take from it?
Not allowed to let it go out. Oh, this is what I wanted to bring out, is it even one coal, even one ember. You can't allow even one to go out. So, yes, there's a positive precept of keeping it going, but then the negative is to protect. You shouldn't even allow one coal to become extinguished. It burns out on its own. That's one thing. You're adding fire to it, but you shouldn't separate like the one coal from the thing so that that goes out. Right. So that we're careful even with a little bit. So it's something to think about in our own selves, mm-hmm. to just be careful about keeping the fire going and not letting it burn out. We need to protect that. So, good. Okay, so next week, no class.
Cincinnati.
Next week, Cincinnati.
Unless we're in Cincinnati.
And the week after that. Right, the week after that, we'll be here again. Okay. Be'ezrat Hashem.
Travel safe.
Thanks.
Just Cincinnati?